Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. On August 5th of 2012, 5 years ago this Saturday, a white supremacist went into the Oak Creek Sikh temple with a 9mm handgun and multiple magazines of ammunition. He shot and killed 6 people and wounded 4 others. One of those who was killed was Satwant Singh Kalika, the president of the temple. Pardeep Kalika, his son, and Arno Michaelis, a former white supremacist, met shortly after the shooting, and you'll have to hear about their meeting. It's quite a story. You will hear about that. Arno is now an activist for peace and justice, and of course, so is Pardeep. They founded Serve to Unite, and they work with students and former extremists, victims of violence, to ease tensions all around the world. Pardeep is a former Milwaukee police officer and teacher in Milwaukee Central City. Arno has written a memoir of his skinhead years and transformation, My Life After Hate. This Saturday, there will be a community event, a 6-kilometer run honoring those who are lost in many other parts of this community event, and we'll be talking about all that has been done to heal and inspire. I will never forget the first anniversary observance, which was, we'll reminisce about that this hour. It was one of the more extraordinary events I have ever attended, and I've lived a long time. Last year, Arno and, we'll just ask them. And Arno, Pardeep and Arno, I asked them what they've been doing the last year, because that's, I think, when we were last in touch. And so they will talk about that. But first, may I welcome you. You're still at it after all these years, and it's great to see both of you. You know, I've interviewed, and I must tell you this, thousands and thousands of people at this point as I get close to retiring, and you are way at the top of the list when the people who have made the greatest impact, because you sit here and you hear these stories, and I am just awestruck by all that you have done. It is just amazing. You know, here's to you. Here's to you. It's just been extraordinary. The great tragedy, all the work you've done. So, hi.
Hey,
thanks for
Kathleen
being with us again.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And let's start on a sad note, which a horrendous note, which was what happened 5 years ago, which I'm sure you can relive with great clarity and with great sorrow, Pardeep.
Yeah. It seems like this sort of weekend, and it's when you said 5 years, it really, time has gone by so fast since then. And you know, part of that is because we've been so busy, and you know, it's just an honor to be on you know, the show and be a guest on the show. But yeah, this weekend comes up, and definitely there is a sense of somber reminder. I've been doing media all week, and just yesterday I had somebody, a media source, ask me, like, so why do you call this a celebration? You know, and I kind of took me back, but then I realized that he didn't know a lot of, like, what the reaction was and what the response was, not by only just our community, but the broader community, and just the resiliency of the community at large. So when I think back to this weekend, it definitely is very somber, but it's you know, somewhat celebratory too, because we are celebrating life, and that's what I think about when I think about August 5th, 2012.
Mm. And the Sikh community, your community, just taught a whole lot of people many things. People, I've talked to people at the hospital who were with people who were dying, and people who had died, but the composure and the, you know, it's almost the serenity about, you taught a lot of people how to grieve and then how to transform this horror into this incredible work that you've done.
Yeah. So the word "sick" itself, and it's you know, ironic that you say that you've taught. So the word "sick" itself means learner, and the place that we learn.
It does,
at,
really.
Yeah, it does. Huh. And it's simply, you know, we use it in common everyday vocabulary, and you say "tuki sikha," meaning, like, what have you learned? Mm. And a Sikh is basically a person that takes on this journey to be a lifelong learner. And the Gurdwara is where they do a lot of their learning. So, you know, August 5th, 2012, not only asked us, like, as a community, as a new immigrant community, what did you learn? But also, I think it asked the entire like, world, what have you learned? And then once you learn from something, it's, you know, we can't stop at awareness. And a lot of people say that, well, education is half the battle. Yeah, but the other part of it is action. And so we need to be able to transform education into action. It's not always that somebody is ignorant. and doesn't know about somebody else. A lot of people do know, but they don't care anyways, because they feel like, you know, we live in a culture that is about service and how much have you given to the American dream, and that's where a lot of this narrative comes from, that new immigrants, new demographics have not given in or sacrificed as much to the American dream to be allowed it.
Hmm.
And I think that's what that day spoke of, is that, you know, we can't sit around waiting for people to accept us. We have to go out and basically show who we are as six.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have, and you continue to. Arno, what were you, your meeting at Pardeep is quite a story. What were your memories of 5 years ago on Saturday?
I was working as an information technology consultant on August 5th, 2012, and I would often work on weekends because then I'm out of the way of the end users and vice versa. So I was in an office of one of my clients by myself working, and as any IT guy will admit, when you're watching those progress bars go, you kind of dip in your social media, especially on the weekends when no one's there. And it was while doing that that I saw on a Twitter feed the first news of the shooting, and it just like caught fire, and I saw this cascade down my computer monitor, shooting situation, mass shooting, multiple dead, multiple shooters, and just all the wild speculation that goes with it. And it's just destroys me to say that all of us in the United States are just, oh, it's the mass shooting protocol. It's what happens every time there's a mass shooting, which we've lost count of, but just between now and 2012. That particular shooting, though, just right off the bat, I had a feeling that this had something to do with the ideology that I had once espoused and propagated and cultivated in society. And later that evening, that was confirmed, but they didn't name the shooter. So I lay awake that night wondering if this was somebody I recruited, somebody I knew personally. And it wasn't until the next day when they named Wade Page as the shooter that after some digging through my foggy memory banks, it hit me that I didn't know him personally. But it didn't really diminish the urgency I felt to respond in a tactical way, which is really to respond with compassion and kindness and forgiveness. And Pardeep and his brother Amardeep and all the other survivors and all of the Sikh community is such an amazing example for me in that regard, and I've just been doing the best I can to follow it ever since.
Mm. And so you got in touch with Pardeep, and I remember you were telling me that I can understand you were a little apprehensive about meeting Arno, aren't you?
Yeah,
yes, I can understand that. So how did the meeting happen, and why did you go to it?
So there was just that day, there was so much mystery, the confusion. There was a lot of stuff that wasn't explained to us, why this happened. Obviously, we could, like Arno said, we could speculate, and there was a lot of wild speculation. So really the inspiration for me reaching out to Arno was that I wanted to understand the why. I really wanted to understand the why from a person who had lived that lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Just that day of, I remember, you know, being in between sort of this weird place of relief that me, my son, and my daughter weren't inside the temple at the time of the shooting, but also this vulnerable sort of guilt, saying that, like, man, you know, I wasn't inside the temple at the time. And it's wrestling with those feelings that was my inspiration to reach out to Arno.
And as a result, the two of you have formed this organization, and you have gone all over the place with it. You've met with that first year when you had that, golly, what a night that was. Yeah. You brought together people from Newtown and from Virginia Tech and all of these people who had been victims of gun violence, and there was a candlelight ceremony, and people, the emotions were just there. It was one extraordinary night, just an extraordinary night, a year after the shooting.
Yeah. You know, people were inspired definitely at that time, and now that I look back at it, 2012, August 5th, 2012, was a political year. And while I think that we achieved a lot of successes, I think there was definitely a few things that still stick with us as a community. And I think part of that, to be honest, was that the sitting president of the time did not openly come to the temple. And, you know, as a community, we felt, why is that? This is, you know, one of the worst race-based hate attacks that this country had seen by an affiliated white supremacist. Why hasn't the president of the United States not come to openly grieve with us? Mm-hmm. And I mean, Michelle Obama came later, but there still wasn't an open showing. And I think that's what led to, not as you said, inspiration, but the dedication, not the commitment to be here 5 years later, really saying to the world, we are worth something. Really saying to America, we are worth something. You should have shown up, and you should show up now.
Mm-hmm. And you're also saying that to all the people that you're working with who probably don't think that they're worth much. You've worked with people who have been victims of trauma. You've worked with people who have perpetrated violence on other human beings. That's very heavy work. That's not easy to do. And you move from being horrible victims of this horrendous violence to being able to reach out to people who were perpetrators of violence, too.
Yeah.
Arno, you've done that with people in Europe, all over this country. How do you do that?
Well, a lot of what my personal mission is to acknowledge the trauma behind violence. And from my experience as a perpetrator, I understand that hurt people hurt people. And the more we can be mindful of that as a society, the better chance we have to interrupt and actually divert violence. And it's very important that we keep that truth that hurt people front and center, because that enables us to respond to aggression with compassion rather than more aggression, which of course only inflames it. Mm-hmm. So when we see that trauma is really the source of violence, then we can kind of dedicate ourselves to work through our own trauma and ideally reach a point where we can help people through their trauma as well. And then ideally those people will repeat that process. So essentially we're going viral with this idea that healing is what needs to happen, rather than vengeance, rather than punishment, rather than some kind of like get even scenario. And I can't blame anybody who is a victim of violence for having thoughts of vengeance or anger. I mean, it's very healthy to be angry sometimes. It's healthy to be outraged. But if we dwell in anger and dwell in outrage, there's no way that we're going to do anything but put more aggression into a system that's already overloaded with it. Mm-hmm. So we really need to think tactically about how to solve these problems, and tactically the best way to do it is with compassion.
Mm-hmm. And you're working in that area, Pardeep, now too. You're a trauma therapist, are you?
Yeah, and I've been fortunate to be able to find sort of a journey in that direction. Is that when me and Arnold first started doing this, obviously, like, front and center was white supremacy, the whole gun control narrative, immigration policy, and all these things. But we kept coming back, you know, trauma, hurt, pain, and how that's taking control of a person's life. Even working with, you know, today we work with men ending violence at the Alma Center, and one of our sayings at the Alma Center is, you know, pain not transformed is transferred or consumed. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're working on right now. How do we transform that pain, not only at a communal level, but even at an individual level?
Well, how do we do that, and how do you learn to teach people to do that?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's different for different people, and it's the circumstances dictate sort of the treatment. I'm a CBT therapist, so I use a lot of cognitive sort of restructuring. of coping skills. So it's you know, people develop, and everything that we develop is a coping skill. Whether it's you know, drinking, whether it's behaviors, they're the way that we deal with life is a coping skill. And so, take a look back and say, okay, what is it that you're coping with? How better can you cope? And really going there, addressing the problem, the root problem of it, because you can have someone who is affected by childhood sort of trauma, sexual violence, things like that, and it can layer up so much so that it looks like something completely different when they get older. And you can say, well, that person's suffering from depression, anxiety, all these other things. But then really coming back and say, okay, well, where was the root cause? What was happening in that person's life? So really approaching it from a biopsychosocial.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I think also what, and this is one of our strong suits, if we're talking about practical ways to begin those healing processes, it's essential that the possibility of healing is demonstrated. So many people, like the more trauma you go through, it's a defense mechanism almost to kind of like become acclimated to that trauma, to the point where sometimes people, the idea of not experiencing that trauma, not going through the struggle, is foreign and more intimidating than the idea of living with it. So when Pardeep and I go and we work with young people, or we're working with municipalities and we're telling our stories, my story proves the possibility of transformation and of reformation. Mm-hmm. It proves that someone who was once a very harmful, dangerous perpetrator of racist violence can not only stop doing that, but become a person who has dedicated themselves to ending that kind of illness in our society. When Pardeep shares his story, you see someone who is in the healing process of his father's murder through helping other people. So now people who have made mistakes, people who have been victims of violence, see that there's a possibility to live in the world in a better way than they are.
And have you seen that happen with people you've worked with? Have you witnessed transformation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sometimes it's just remarkable how
really?
You witness it, like, and at the degree in which you witness it. But once people start to actually, like, process a lot of the pain, they do change, and you know, we not only see it in individual clients, but you see it in groups. You see, you know, people who have gone through like trauma help each other, and so it's never to say, you know, I'm the teacher, I'm the sort of the priest, the guru, the whatever, but to say that, you know what, you might be on a journey where you have to be your own guru, you have to do your own journey. So it's likened to, I can bring the weights to you, but I need you to lift too.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the work. You've worked with Arts at Large for a number of years, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering the use of how you use art in order to transform.
Yeah. What Surf Unite does is we engage young people, so far it's been from second grade through college, in service learning and global engagement. And this work is all tied together via the arts. So an excellent example is this past spring semester, one of our flagship projects was our Serve Unite chapter at Mesmer Catholic High School had the idea to do outreach to the Muslim community of Milwaukee to organize food and clothing drives for homeless veterans. We partner with an amazing organization called Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin, and they were our vehicle to actually go and serve homeless vets. So to do this, they had guidance from one of our global mentors, a woman named Yasmin Mulbakas in London, who was a former recruiter for an Islamist group called Al-Mujahideen.
Oh, my gosh.
And she had since changed her life around and then is currently helping young people stay away from those kind of extremist mm-hmm. ideologies, particularly young women. So Yasmin would get into our classroom via Skype and advise our young people at the Catholic High School how to do outreach to the Muslim community of Milwaukee with Yasmin's guidance. They made a great contact at a local mosque. We all went there for a field trip, spent the day together talking about our respective faiths. There were young people from Salam School, the Muslim high school, who had lunch with our Catholic high school students. And the food and clothing drive commenced. The mosque loved the idea. One of the elders at the mosque was a veteran himself. They said, yeah, of course, we'd love to help. And over the course of a couple months, the mosques gathered so much food and clothing that on the day that we loaded it onto the Veterans Outreach Wisconsin truck, it was myself, Parr, I think we had like six of our students, a couple parents, four people from the mosque, and then one of the people from Veterans Outreach. And it took the lot of us about 15, 20 minutes to load this truck. There was just so much stuff, and the Muslim community was so... It helped with so much joy and zeal to help people who had served our country. So that in a nutshell is what Serve to Unite does. That's service learning, it's global engagement, and the arts come into play as our students documented this, whether it was through writing or through photography. Our students also created a mural that is now going to hang in the community room at Veterans Outreach Wisconsin.
Wonderful.
That it's basically like a really beautiful heart with an American flag saying you are not alone for all the people that they serve.
Mm. So, I mean, the other part of that, arts becomes the way to express. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times we hear this is national, but trauma-informed practices. And while that is, you know, that's definitely, that, you know, and needs to take some precedent, we also have to understand, like, when does it become trauma-addressed? Meaning that, it's good to know that it's there, but how do we actually address it? And arts becomes that expressive piece. So now you write it, you draw it, you dance it, you act it.
Yes.
And it really, like, gives voice to trauma survivors.
Yes. And where else have you been since I last saw you? You told me that you had done some work in Massachusetts somewhere. What was going on there?
Yeah, so, I mean, we're fortunate to be able to go to different neighborhoods. And I say neighborhood because this place wasn't a big city. Groton, Massachusetts, we were out there about 2 months ago to do some consulting and some work with policymakers, law enforcement, concerned citizens. Groton, Massachusetts is a town. It's traditionally a white town, a very Christian town. They have traditions that they hold very sacred. One of the sacred traditions that they have is their town emblem, which was basically a Bible that said Bible on there and with crosses all around it. And some of the people in the town were sort of conflicted that kind of sent a message that other people were not welcome. And then there was other people in the town who thought that they needed to preserve that heritage and that culture. And so, we had a discussion with the town and trying to find, so like, what are the solutions to the changing demographic? Mm. They were having a Hindu mandir coming into town. Actually, they were having two Hindu mandirs coming into town. And a lot of the cultural preservation townspeople were sort of like, well, that's going to change our religion, it's going to change our town, and we want to preserve it. The other ones wanted to be more welcoming. So the solution eventually became that they're going to engage in the political process inside of this mandir. So instead of having the election at the church, they were going to have it inside this Hindu mandir. And that way the new community members would be able to engage with the older community members. And so it's 'cause something like that's a lot of the stuff that we do is like going to different towns and trying to, like, how do we develop solutions?
Right. It's valuable work. How do you explain, you mentioned this earlier, it's funny how themes come up in shows, and I think that in the last 3 days we've had some pretty profound conversations about immigration. on this program when it came to Abraham Lincoln and the know-nothings of the 1850s, or, I mean, he wasn't associated with that, but mm-hmm. it was during the time of Lincoln, or what's come out today in terms of really limiting legal immigration to this country and looking for high-skilled people to come here. You mentioned immigration, too. I'm wondering what the story is of sick arrival in the United States and if immigration has been hard, and how both of you respond to there's a real anti-immigrant feeling in the country. There's a lot of hatred that's going on from people who aren't what you are, or mm-hmm. not very welcoming times. So address the times through immigration, if you would.
Sure. So just the population number-wise, there's about 500,000 sick in the United States, 500,000 give or take, or those that openly identify as six. There's about 30 million worldwide. And, you know, six are a pretty new demographic group to the United States. A lot of them live in very urban areas. So to Milwaukee's right now in the southeastern Wisconsin area is growing in the number amount of six. When we first came here in the 80s, there's only about 10 families.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so, I mean, not many at all. And now there's nearly 1,000 families, maybe like 3,000 or 4,000 who identify as six. With that said, I am concerned about the sort of the tension with the anti-immigrant sentiment that's coming out of not only just your normal person, but leadership. And I think that a lot of it just justifies people doing things and really targeting not only Sikhs, but visual sort of, you know, the United States is very visual. So it's targeting marginalized populations by what you can see as different. And so you're concerned about that. But I think we know that this has been a problem that has existed for a long time.
Yes.
And so when things come to the surface, it's the responsibilities of communities to step up and really address those problems, not take a step back and say, well, you know what, we're not going to engage in that because we don't like that. Right now we have a lot of people who are not engaging and solving the problem, and so they take a step back and leave marginalized populations vulnerable and at risk.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a responsibility of you know, the whole community just to kind of step up when they see this.
I don't know. What do you say about this issue?
One of the most important and powerful truths I've learned on my journey is that as human beings, we find what we look for in life. And if you're intimidated by immigrants, you feel threatened by them, you're going to look for reasons to validate that feeling. You're going to look for reasons to think that immigrants are criminals and reasons to think that they're a burden on our society. And because we all find what we look for, you will find them if you look hard enough. That applies to whatever direction you look, though. And as my closest friend on earth is a first-generation immigrant, and I look at immigrant populations, I see that there's really nobody in this country who works harder than a fresh immigrant, than someone who just got here. And that goes whether they come here from Punjab in the 80s, or they came here from Ireland in the late 1800s, or they came here from Vietnam in the 70s. All of these people, when they first get here, are just in awe of the opportunity that they have here. And when I really look to see the souls of these people who have come to our country, and I believe honestly and completely with all authenticity that they make this country great. They make this country a better place. These are people who start businesses. These are people who create jobs, not a draw upon the system. So if I'm thinking about immigration, I challenge anyone who feels that immigration is a bad thing to really open themselves up and to be a devil's advocate to their argument. And I would respond to the challenge by saying I spent 7 years of my life saying that immigrants are the bane of our existence. So I've been on that side. I've been on both sides of this perspective. And over the years and over my experience, I've come to see that the more valid perspective of the two is that, you know, what is the American dream all about? And what can we learn from immigrant populations to make ourselves better and to make us more valuable contributors to society in the United States?
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests, and here's how you reach us. We're speaking with Pardeep Kalika and Arno Michaelis. They've been working together since the horrible shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, which took place 5 years ago this Saturday. Pardeep and Arno have worked with Serve to Unite. They work with students, former extremists, victims of violence, and they work with populations really all over the world. Pardeep is a former police officer in Milwaukee. He's a teacher in Milwaukee Central City, has done that. Arno has written a memoir of his skinhead years and transformation, My Life After Hate. In the last year, they've been working with Arts at Large. They've worked with Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin. They have worked with sexual assault survivors and bringing students from all kinds of backgrounds together for a big celebration to celebrate diversity and do work combating trauma, addressing trauma in communities all over. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, and we will talk more about the event coming up this Saturday, too, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. All right, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we have room to take some phone calls. We're talking about transformation, and we'll go to phone calls in a moment. They're just coming in. I wanted to make sure we mentioned what's happening this Saturday. Mm-hmm. It's another commemoration. It's a run and what else, party?
Yeah, it's a 6K run walk, 1K for each one of the victims that passed away that day. We do have a seventh victim who has been in a vegetative state for 5 years
now. Oh, my gosh.
And his name is Bubba Punjab Singh. He's an amazing soul, communicates through his eyes, and we will have a keynote speaker who will speak for him. We will have, festivities, food, everything is free. Just bring your kids, participate. We would ask for people to bring food for Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin, non-perishables, and just give blood. If you want to, but definitely it's all free, participatory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you still doing work? I know you did on the first anniversary. Are you doing work with victims of gun violence too?
We work with victims of gun violence, but not directly. We still work with policymakers on gun violence and really address that problem. That typically my victims of gun violence are coming to me because they have mental health concerns.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls. Owen in Waiwega is our first caller. Hi, Owen.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Great.
Good.
Just the point I wanted to make was I work with illegal immigrants, and they pay taxes, income taxes, and they pay Social Security. Neither one of them they really benefit from because they have no right to vote, and they have no right to collect the Social Security they're paying in. So we need to make sure that the people that are already here that are undocumented and illegal at this time can get a path to citizenship so they have a right to use what they're paying in.
Hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you're working in this country, I think that illegal is illegal. We can't sell illegal drugs to make our businesses better, and we can't hire illegal labor. We need to have labor that can vote and that can get the benefits from all the taxes they pay and the Social Security, both things. I mean, this is important. These guys work hard every day, and they get nothing from all the taxes they pay.
And without telling too many details about what work you're doing with those who are here illegally, is there a fear among the people you're working with that they are going to be deported?
Absolutely. They don't like to go anywhere because of that, yes.
Which means they're not outspending money, too.
Well, they're spending money. They make 4-to-1 ratio on their money, and they send a lot of it back home. They've got children in college in Mexico. They've got houses in Mexico that they're paying for, 100-year leases on sugarcane fields, things like that. They're getting a lot from the money they're making here, mm-hmm. but they're sending it to Mexico.
Sure.
And they buy a lot of food here. They eat very well. They all eat as a family, and they eat big meals 3 times a day.
Oh, sure. What I'm saying is that if that fear of deportation wasn't hanging over them, they would be out spending more money in our economy here. And that obviously would be good for all of us.
Because with the fact they have no driver's licenses, if they drive brand new vehicles, they're less likely to get picked up.
Yeah, that too. Good point.
So they do have brand new American cars. They all drive brand new American cars.
Yeah. Well, thank you for what you do, and keep it up.
Thanks, Owen. Let's go to Martin in Duluth. Hi, Martin.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I think it's so important to take immigrants in this country if we're able to, and I think they, you know, I don't know if I articulate this correctly or clearly, but I think that they can appreciate the democracy that we have more than people have lived here for a long time and sort of take it for granted. The other thing I'm interested in, if anybody has any idea, is percentage-wise. I mean, do immigrants that can vote, I wonder what the percentage is, because I have this funny suspicion that the percentage of immigrants or newly immigrants probably vote more than people who have lived here for a long time, and I'd like to just make that comment.
I'm not sure that was true in the last election. I think that there was a expectation that immigrants would be voting in very large numbers, particularly Mexican immigrants, and I don't think the numbers were as high as people thought they were going to be. That's my
sure.
my take on the election. Is anybody disagree?
No, I mean, I don't know about the number of people that can vote from people that can't, but you know, one of the stats that does come up quite a bit as far as even addressing this demographic trauma is in the year 2050, whites will stop being the majority in the country,
right,
and be the minority. It is a speculative sort of fear. But mm-hmm. with that said, you said it right. I mean, you said it right, that we have the ability to become a multicultural, multi-ethnic, true democracy if we work at it. And that is a beacon that the world can look at.
You know, is there, let's talk about this for a while, because what you said is really significant. It will be a majority minority country, and that's just down the road. It's going to be here before we know it. For you, I won't be around anymore, but it'll be here for you. Does that scare people?
It doesn't scare me at all.
No, I can imagine it doesn't, Marty. It doesn't scare me either, but it must scare people.
It's back in the day when I was involved in hate groups, a common recruiting angle of ours was that the birth rate for white people globally for many, many years has been negative, actually. There's been more white people dying than new white people being born. And for everyone else, collectively, it's been positive by a good couple points. So that's true. Pretty much all violent extremist mindsets will find these shreds of truth and then spin them to suit their ideology. And so the way we would spin it is that they're coming for us. It's going to be all this violence against white people. It's going to be all this backlash against white people. And we would use that as a seed of fear to capitalize on as we were recruiting people into our hate groups. Today, that's no less true. White people will be a minority in the United. We've been a minority globally for a very long time, but by 2050, we'll be a minority in the United States. And in all likelihood, 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now, there won't be any white people as we know them today. I'm completely at peace with that. I'm looking forward to that day. But I think a really important thing to understand is that we have to begin the healing process from 500 years of white supremacy now. And that healing process can't look like switching the roles by turning the tables and like, okay, now white people, now you're going to get yours. That's all. What that is, it's a recipe for ongoing violence until this last person, white person's around in 5-6 centuries, And then after that, the violence will continue. Throughout the world, it's been very plain that every time colonial oppressive nations have been expelled from countries, the violence doesn't end there. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, sometimes it gets worse after that. And the reason why is because the violence can never solve violence. So I believe the solution to 500 years of white supremacy is understanding that all of us as human beings have far more in common than otherwise, and we need to cultivate that truth of our common humanity. Once we have done that, now we're in a position to address issues like white privilege, like heteronormativity, the whole laundry list of issues that social justice warriors are concerned about. What the problem that I see happening right now is all those issues are front and center without that common humanity foundation to address them from. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, it only exacerbates the problem.
Thanks. Martin, did you have anything else? Martin's gone. Thank you very much for your call. Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi.
Hi. All of this discussion reminded me of a Peter Marshall quote that my mom would say when I was young, many years ago. And I can't remember it exactly, but it was Peter Marshall. And if you Google him, you'll be inspired. But it went something like this: there is so much bad in the best of us and so much good in the worst of us. It behooves any of us to talk about the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah, it's a good one. I've heard that before. Thank you, Deborah. Thanks for the call. Have you asked former President Obama to join you in each one of the memorials that take place? Because he should go to one of those.
Yeah, he should. And yes. To my knowledge, there has been no sitting president who has visited a Sikh temple in the United States.
Really?
And maybe one of them. We want to update the stats on that, but I to my knowledge, I do bring it up in interviews, and I definitely, August 2012 was definitely a very tough political year. I get it, and at the same time, but it does come back to our community was re-victimized by the response and saying, okay, what if this shooter had been a Muslim, and what if the community had been church-going white people?
Right.
Would the
Absolutely.
Response have been different by mm-hmm. the U.S. president? And we can't help but to compare sometimes. I'd love the response by the broader community. I never want to diminish and say, because just that same day, Kathleen, people were showing up after they got out of their Sunday worship. They showed up at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin and grieved together as the day was going on. And that gave us a ton of support, mm-hmm. but we do sit back and say, okay, what would it have been different? Would there have been an open display of support by the standing president or whoever was running for president mm-hmm. at the time, if this was a different demographic, and the visible appearance of Sikhs being turbans and beards, we couldn't have help but to think maybe it was our visibility that detracted from that person coming to be shown with us.
Right. Yeah, it should have happened. Of course it should have happened. Yeah. How did you ever get mixed up with this white supremacy? Were you a kid or what was going on?
A lot of it has to do with my personality type. I'm a adrenaline junkie from day one. I've always been someone who enjoyed causing problems and making people angry and up overturning the apple carts and whatnot. That combined with growing up in an alcoholic household, which really put my mother through a lot of stress, and her suffering kind of transferred to me as a kid, and I started lashing out at other kids very early. I was a bully on the school bus, and I got a kick out of it. So like any other kind of substance abuse, what gets you off the first time 10 times later is old hat, and you got to keep elevating it. So I went from a bully on the school bus to fights in the schoolyard to fights in the street to breaking and entering to vandalism. When I was a teenager, I started drinking myself, and I was really wild, really violent, and I really, really love to make people angry. Mm-hmm. I love to repulse people. And if you think of Mohawk repulse, I still do. But I've just figured out a way to do it in a constructive way today. Nowadays,
I'm glad that you're
destructive. But so my attraction to the swastika initially was that it repulsed people. I was willfully ignorant of the reason why people were repulsed, but I just wanted to get a rise out of people. And once I started broadcasting hate and violence into the world around me, the world, as it does with whatever we put into it, reflected it back to me, oftentimes in multiples, so that within 6 months of starting the gang, my best friend had went to prison for shooting a kid that came to do a drive-by in our house. Within 2 years, another best friend was shot and killed in a street fight.
Oh, Arno.
And rather than take responsibility for those things and say, hey, maybe this is because, you know, we're living by the sword and we're dying by the sword, instead, the nature of violent extremist ideology, whether it's racist or religious or political or whatever, is always that instead of taking responsibility for the bed you made, it's everybody else's fault. So and then you get stuck in this feedback loop that just, it's a pit. And I honestly think that's, we can only speculate as to why Wade Page murdered six people that day, but I honestly believe that that's why. He had got himself so caught up in this feedback loop where he was in his mid-40s, he worked a minimum wage job, his girlfriend had just dumped him, his family had disowned him, his entire life was crumbling before his eyes, and rather than say, hey, what could I do differently? He's like, oh, this is the blacks' fault, it's the Jews' fault, it's the Sikhs' fault, it's the gays' fault, it's every, you know, this huge laundry list of everybody whose fault it is but his. And of course, that's just going to make him more miserable.
Yeah. Oh, Deborah, thanks so much for your call. Chuck in Sauk County. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. See, I was just going to say that I doubt if most of our legislators or even probably high school students could pass the citizenship test that these folks have to pass in order to get their citizenship.
Good point.
I mean, I looked it over, you know, online. I mean, that really makes you think.
I haven't looked at one in a long time.
Yeah.
You got to take a look at it. I will.
Chuck, I had to pass one of those to become a naturalized citizen. So, yeah, it is difficult.
Was it hard? Did you have to study?
A little bit.
Yeah. Well, you're a smart guy. Yeah. You pass with flying colors,
Thank
I'm
you.
Sure. Yeah,
Thank
thanks
you.
Very much.
Thanks, Chuck.
That would be a challenge. We should all be required, maybe, to take that. Maybe think differently about things. We'll welcome more phone calls in a moment. Pardeep Kalika, Arno Michaelis are our guests. This is the Ideas Network. Our number is 800-486-8655. Just a couple minutes left, gentlemen, and let me say again how pleased I am that you could be with us. I'm interested in the work. You've talked about meeting with students from second grade all the way up through college, and it's suburbs and it's city. And what? Tell me more about what you do with students.
Pardeep? Yes. So the mission working with students really started 5 years ago, and shortly after the shooting, when we partnered up with Arts at Large, and Arts at Large giving us the vehicle to be able to go into those schools and address some of the issues that students are facing. At that time, there was a exhibit on bullying, and you know, Terry Sullivan, who's the director of Arts at Large, reached out to us and just heard us somewhere and said, you know what, I want to bring you guys into a few schools. Can we try something out? And as we went in there, we just realized the power of storytelling. And just, you know, getting students to engage in empathy, like true empathy towards not only just our story, but to their own stories, and understanding the role that forgiveness, compassion, and these soft skills plays. I think that's a very under-addressed subject matter in schools, and I think that we owe it. I mean, it's our responsibility as, you know, those that work in the educational capacity to really address social emotional growth within youth. So, I mean, that's how we got our start, and we've been working at that since. And just the mission has gotten a little bit bigger, but you know, our heart is really with the youth in the city. I think, you know, they're going to be the next leaders. They're going to be the next politicians, the, you know, next police officers. And if we don't address that at that age, we're going to see, you know, if we don't address it, we're going to see a society that is not engaged in empathy.
Yeah. Carry on, gentlemen. All the best to both of you. I admire both
Thank
of you,
you so
greatly.
Much,
Thank you. Thanks so much. And August 5th will be the event that will take place. It's open. It's free. It's a 6K run. There are lots of other events going on. It's at the Oak Creek High School, right, Pardeep? Mm-hmm. And yep, what's the time?
It's at, the race starts at 9 a.m., and we invite everyone to visit ck6k.org to register, and all the event information is at that site as well.
Thank you. Our thanks to Pardeep Kalika and Arnold Michaelis, and thanks to all of you for listening and for your calls. Thanks to Gretchen Brown for producing the hour, to Colleen Leahy for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again mañana at 1 o'clock when we talk once again about the future of healthcare.